Coming up on Star Stuff, astronomers find tropical lakes on the Saturnian moon Titan. Speculation grows that Voyager 1 is about to become the first man-made object to leave the solar system. And the United States Air Force X-37B space shuttle has successfully glided to a landing at the Vandenberg Air Force Base following a top-secret 15-month orbital mission. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
NASA's Cassini spacecraft has detected long-standing methane lakes in the tropics of Saturn's moon Titan. One of the lakes appears to be about half the size of Utah's Great Salt Lake and has a depth of at least a meter. The discovery, reported in the journal Nature, is unexpected. That's because models had always assumed long-standing bodies of liquid on Titan would exist primarily at the poles. Astronomers analysing data from NASA's Cassini spacecraft believe the lakes are being fed by an underground aquifer. So, in essence, Titan may have oases. Understanding how lakes or wetlands form on Titan will help scientists learn more about the Saturnian moon's weather. Like Earth's hydrological cycle, Titan has a methane cycle, with the circulation liquid being methane rather than water. In Titan's atmosphere, ultraviolet light breaks apart methane, initiating a chain of complicated organic chemical reactions. But existing models haven't been able to account for the abundant supply of methane. Now, astronomers think an aquifer could explain one of the puzzling questions about the existence of methane, which is being continually depleted. Methane is a progenitor of Titan's organic chemistry, which likely produces interesting molecules like amino acids, the building blocks of life. Global circulation models of Titan have theorized that liquid methane in the moon's equatorial region evaporates, and it's then carried by Titan's winds to the north and south pole, where cooler temperatures cause the methane to condense out and fall as rain. When this methane rain reaches the surface, it forms polar lakes. On Earth, water is similarly transported by the circulation, but Earth has massive oceans which also transport water, thereby countering the atmospheric effects. The latest results come from Cassini's virtual and infrared mapping spectrometer, which detected the dark areas in the tropical region known as Shangri-La, near the very spot where the European Space Agency's Huygens probe landed in 2005. In fact, when Huygens touched down, the heat of the probe's landing lamp was enough to vaporize some of the methane on the ground, indicating it had landed in a damp area. An area appears dark to the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer aboard Cassini when liquid ethane or methane are present. Some regions could be shallow, ankle-deep puddles. Others, however, are much deeper. Up until this new discovery, Cassini's radar mapper has seen lots of lakes in the polar region, but hasn't detected any at lower latitudes. The tropical lakes detected by the visual and infrared mapping spectrometer on Cassini have been there since at least 2004, indicating their fairly permanent features. Only once has rain been detected falling and evaporating the equatorial regions. And that only happened during the recent and expected rainy season on Titan. Scientists therefore think the lakes could not be significantly replenished by rain. So astronomers concluded that Titan simply had extensive dunes at the equator and lakes at the poles. But the new Cassini data shows that Titan's far more complex than previously thought. Dr. Brad Carter is an astronomer with the University of Southern Queensland.
Titan is still giving us surprises. What we're seeing, of course, is that Titan appears to have methane lakes at the equator as well as at the poles. And this is unexpected because what has been thought until now is that there's evaporation of the methane at the equator. It heads towards the poles and then condenses and you form lakes at the poles, but not much in the way of a lake at the equator. So this latest result is quite a surprise because there's fairly clear evidence of substantial lakes of methane at Titan's equator.
There was always speculation that the actual location where the Huygens probe landed was sort of like a wet sand almost, which was caused by methane rain.
Exactly so. So from as far as I can tell, I think Huygens was lucky not to be in a lake somewhere because if you look at a picture of these lakes, you know, they're sort of at the similar latitudes as to where the Huygens probe landed. So I think it was a bit of luck that Huygens landed on something approaching solid surface rather than in a lake somewhere.
If we forget that we're talking about methane and ethane and just consider it as a hydrological cycle, it's really a very similar picture to what we have here at Earth in terms of, you know, rivers and deltas and lakes and oceans and that sort of thing.
Exactly so. It's quite extraordinary to see the similarity between the methane cycle on Titan and the water cycle on the Earth. And even though it's much lower temperature, given that Titan's surface temperature is about 180 degrees below zero Celsius, otherwise it is an extraordinary analogue, if you like, of the lakes and rivers and sort of environment that we expect on Earth with the water cycle.
The thing I found interesting too was the fact that Titan has a rainy season.
Yes, indeed it does. And when that occurs, of course, you expect more rain of methane rather than water.
Where to next with Cassini? Will it be going back to Titan? Will it have another look at that part of the Saturnian system?
Almost certainly, I think so, because the methane on Titan presents us with essentially two mysteries, and that is where the methane comes from, given that a process called photolysis should very effectively turn the methane into ethane and get rid of hydrogen out of the atmosphere, and we should lose a lot of that methane in 20 million years. But given that Titan is 4.6 billion years old, there are essentially two mysteries that need to be solved. One is, where is the source of the methane? And I think this latest research are showing not only surface lake of methane, the implication, of course, is there's an underground aquifer, a big source of methane. So maybe that mystery is beginning to be solved. We're sort of getting a clearer idea now of where the methane's coming from. It's coming from below the surface. But the other mystery that's yet to be solved is essentially why there isn't a lot more ethane, because, again, the standard models for Titan predict the conversion of methane, one hydrocarbon, to another form called ethane. And we're seeing lots of methane rather than ethane. And so the presence of methane and the relative absence of ethane are both scientific problems that are yet to be really fully understood.
I guess it's really not all that surprising to find Titan has variations on its surface. After all, you'd expect to see that on a planet, and Titan is bigger than Mercury, which is a planet.
Exactly so. In fact, Titan is something like 40% the diameter of Earth. It's about 5,000 kilometres across. So it's very much a substantial world in its own right. If it weren't for the fact that it's going around Saturn, I think I'd be happy to call it a planet in its own right.
That's Dr. Brad Carter, an astronomer with the University of Southern Queensland. New data coming from NASA's Voyager 1 spacecraft, which is flying through the unexplored outer rim at the very edge of the solar system, indicates the probe is getting closer to interstellar space. The new readings show the probe has encountered a region where the intensity of charged particles from beyond the solar system has markedly increased. Voyager scientists looking at this rapid rise are drawing closer to the inevitable but historic conclusion that humanity's first emissary to interstellar space is on the edge of leaving the solar system. Scientists with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, say the latest data indicates Voyager 1 has entered a new region where things are changing more rapidly. The data, making the 16-hour, 38-minute, 17.8 billion kilometre journey from the spacecraft to the antennas of NASA's Deep Space Network on Earth, are showing an increase in the number of charged particles measured by the two high-energy telescopes aboard the 34-year-old spacecraft. These particles were generated when stars in our cosmic neighbourhood went supernova. From January 2009 through to January 2012, there had been a gradual increase of about 25% in the amount of galactic cosmic rays Voyager was encountering. But more recently, scientists have been seeing a very rapid escalation in that part of the energy spectrum. In fact, beginning on May the 7th, the cosmic ray hits have increased 5% in a week and 9% in a month. The marked increase is one of a triad of data sets which need to be made in order to achieve significant swings in the needle to indicate a new era of space exploration, namely mankind's first journey into interstellar space. The second important measure of the spacecraft's two instruments is the intensity of energetic particles generated inside the heliosphere, the bubble of charged particles carried by the sun's solar wind. While there's been a slow decline in the measurement of these energetic particles, they've not dropped off precipitously, which is what scientists expect to happen when Voyager breaks through the solar boundary. The final data set, which Voyager scientists believe will reveal a major change, is the direction of the magnetic field line surrounding the spacecraft. While Voyager is still within the heliosphere, these field lines are running east to west. However, when it passes into interstellar space, scientists expect Voyager will find the magnetic field lines orient in a more north-south direction. Of course, such analyses will take weeks, and the Voyager team is currently crunching the numbers on its latest data set. When the two Voyager spacecraft were launched back in 1977 on their grand tour of the outer solar system, the space age was just 20 years old. While many on the Voyager team always dreamed of reaching interstellar space, they had no real way of knowing just how long such a journey would take, or for that matter, if the two Voyager spacecraft could even operate long enough to reach interstellar space. Still, Voyager 1 and 2 are both in good health. Voyager 2 even has its own Twitter feed, and it's now more than 14.7 billion kilometers away from the Sun, traveling in a different direction. And as the Voyager probes continue their journey through these unexplored regions of the solar system, we'll keep you informed. A massive asteroid more than half a kilometre wide has flown past the Earth less than a week after it was first detected. The near-Earth object, 2012 LZ1, was discovered by Australian National University astronomer Rob McNaught and colleagues from the Siding Springs Observatory in far western New South Wales. The huge space rock's closest approach was 7.5 million kilometres from Earth, about 14 times the Earth-Moon distance. While there was never any chance of it colliding with the Earth, scientists are concerned that such a huge asteroid, again over half a kilometre across, was able to get so close before anyone was able to see it. So far, NASA has catalogued over 9,000 near-Earth objects. And as for 2012 LZ1, it'll be back in 4 years' time. The United States Air Force X-37B space shuttle has successfully landed at the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, following a top-secret 15-month orbital mission. The reusable winged space plane, known only as Orbital Test Vehicle 2, or OTV-2, glided to a smooth touchdown at the base's main runway, 210 kilometers up the coast from Los Angeles. OTV-2 blasted off aboard an Atlas V rocket from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida on March 5, 2010. It was only the second US vehicle to make an autonomous runway landing from space. The first was its sister X-37B, OTV-1, which flew on a similar mission back in 2010, also landing at the Vandenberg Air Force Base after spending 224 days in orbit. The two reusable 5-ton, 9-meter-long winged spaceplanes were built by Boeing's Phantom Works as part of a program originally started by NASA and eventually taken over by the military when NASA funding ran out. The US Air Force won't disclose what OTV-2 was doing during its 469 days in orbit. Suffice to say, it was a case of mischief managed. A third X-37B mission has already been slated for launch in a few months' time. That will be the second mission for OTV-1, which carried out the X-37B's maiden spaceflight back in 2010. China's first female taikonaut, 33-year-old fighter pilot Liu Yang, is in orbit today following a successful weekend launch aboard Shenzhou 9. The spectacular launch was covered live by China Network Television.
All staff pay attention. 1 minute. This is number zero, Commander. 1 minute preparation. 50 seconds.
Well, the adapter.
40 seconds.
seconds.
20 seconds. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, Three, two, one. Ignition. Lifting off.
USB 跟踪正常，遥测信号正常，双层光学雷达跟踪正常。
The 62-meter-tall Long March 2F rocket blasted off from the remote Jiuquan Satellite Launch Center in the northwestern Gobi Desert on Saturday. 2 days later, the Shenzhou, or Divine Vessel, together with its crew of three Taikonauts, successfully carried out China's first manned docking in space as the capsule mated up with the Tianangong-1 orbital module 340 kilometers above the ground. The successful docking with the Tianangong, or Heavenly Palace module, was the most critical challenge facing the mission, which is all part of China's efforts to play catch-up with Russian and American manned space programs. The flight was Beijing's fourth manned space mission since the country's first Taikonaut was launched in 2003. The 10.5-meter-long Tianangong-1 is a trial module, not a fully-fledged space station. It was launched last September to test Chinese rendezvous and docking techniques, such as those which were mastered by the US and Soviet Union decades ago. But their skills Beijing needs to perfect if China hopes to have its own orbital space station by 2020. Beijing's also talking about a manned mission to the moon sometime after 2020 as the final step of a three-stage moon plan, which includes the deployment of a lunar rover in 2013 and a sample return mission to the moon in 2017. NASA's Nuclear Spectroscopic Telescope Array, NuSTAR, has been successfully launched into orbit aboard a Pegasus rocket high above the Pacific Ocean.
T-minus 15 seconds. Pilot is go for launch. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop. And Pegasus is away. Standing by for ignition. And we have stage one ignition. Ignition of the Pegasus rocket with NuSTAR for an understanding of the ultimate destinies of our stars and galaxies.
Fin actuator system operating nominally. Fins following commands and controlling the flight of the vehicle. Power bus is strong. PDU is enabled. Vehicle flight path is nominal. Flying the normal trajectory.
This is Steve Hollow, our launch systems engineer.
Stage one ignition time was 16.0042. Attitude remains nominal. Past max Q. Power bus is strong. Nominal voltage and current on all buses. Fast power bus strong. Passing 100,000 feet.
The Pegasus was air-launched at 40,000 feet from the underbelly of Stargazer, Orbital Sciences' specially modified Lockheed L-1011 TriStar airliner. The 17.6-meter-long, 18.5-ton, three-stage solid-fuel Pegasus rocket carried the NuSTAR probe into LEO, or low-Earth orbit. Scientists say NuSTAR will be capable of unprecedented spatial and spectral resolution, examining the previously poorly explored hard X-ray region of the electromagnetic spectrum, searching through gas and dust to reveal buried black holes lurking in the depths of the Milky Way, as well as those hidden in the hearts of other galaxies. NuSTAR is designed to provide complementary data to NASA's larger missions, including Fermi, Chandra, Hubble, and Spitzer. 13 minutes after launch from its Stargazer mothership, NuSTAR separated successfully from the Pegasus rocket, spreading its solar panels to charge the spacecraft's battery and reporting back to Mission Control at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratories in Pasadena, California, that the spacecraft was in good health. NuSTAR's unique telescope design includes a 10-meter mast, which was folded away in a small canister during the launch. In a few days' time, mission controllers will send commands to the spacecraft to extend this mast. Science operations will begin about 23 days after that. NuSTAR will be the first telescope to focus high-energy X-rays, making images that will be 10 times crisper and 100 times more sensitive than any other telescope that's operated in the extreme X-ray part of the spectrum. NuSTAR is more potent than any of its predecessors because of the way it focuses high-energy X-ray light by using nestled shells of mirrors to prevent the light from reflecting off. It's equipped with 133 nestled mirrors in each of two optical units. The telescope also uses state-of-the-art detectors. They're connected to the optical units by the 10-metre mast, allowing enough distance for a sharp focus. New Star will open a new window on the universe, studying not just black holes, but also galaxy clusters and supernova remnants, helping astronomers to better understand some fundamental cosmic mysteries. See, just 20 years ago, scientists thought black holes were rare oddities in the cosmos. Now they know that these immense gravity wells lie at the heart of most, if not all, galaxies. But they're hidden from plain sight behind a veil of gas and dust. New Star will penetrate that curtain. It will study black holes and compact stellar objects, the supernova remnants of dead stars. It will also try to understand the forces which power relativistic jet particles that beam out of black holes and which are visible right across the universe. Closer to home, New Star will also study the Sun, examining microflares on the solar surface and trying to understand why the solar atmosphere gets hotter rather than cooler the further away you get from the Sun's surface. And the probe will also focus on targets of opportunity, things like gamma ray bursts, supernovae, and the origins of cosmic rays. Well, after being very quiet for a very long period of time, it seems Sea Launch are back in business, sending a Zenith 3SL rocket into orbit carrying a new telecommunications satellite for Intelsat. The flight was the first of three slated for this year. Once it reaches geostationary orbit, the 5,600-kilogram Space Systems Laurel built Intelsat 19 will provide telecommunications links across the Pacific Rim from the United States West Coast to Japan and Australia. Sea Launch is a joint Russian, Norwegian, Ukrainian and American company managed by Boeing, based in Bern, Switzerland and housed at Long Beach, California. The company uses a converted 30,000-ton North Sea oil platform called Ocean Odyssey as a free-floating launch pad, which is moved to a position 154 degrees west longitude on the equator in the Central Pacific Ocean for each launch. Ocean Odyssey is equipped with a hangar to house the rocket during transport, as well as launch pad rollout and erector facilities, and storage for the kerosene rocket fuel and cryogenic liquid oxygen used as propellant for the launch. Working with Ocean Odyssey is the 34,000-ton Sea Launch Commander, a purpose-built vessel which provides rocket assembly facilities, launch control and mission management services, flight telemetry and tracking data, and accommodation for Sea Launch personnel. The 58-metre-tall Ukrainian-built two-stage liquid-fueled Zenit rocket was originally designed to take over manned Soviet spaceflight from Soyuz prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Zenit 3SL uses a Block DMSL third stage built by the Russian firm Energia, and it's capable of placing a 6,000-kilogram payload into geostationary transfer orbit. And time now once again to turn our eyes to the skies. Jeff White, Senior Astronomy Educator with the Powerhouse Museum Sydney Observatory. He joins us now as we check out the night sights for June on Skywatch.
And what we're going to do for the month of June, we're going to start off shortly after sunset looking towards the west. Roughly two clenched fists or one handspan above the western horizon, you should be able to see the brightest star in the night sky. It's not going to appear as bright as it would if it were overhead, because you're looking through a lot more atmosphere and it's going to make it look somewhat dimmer. You're looking at a star that's twice the mass of the Sun, 25 times brighter, but at a distance of 8.6 light years away. It's simply the brightest star in the night sky. It's called Sirius the Dog Star. I hear you say you've heard that name before. Yes, of course, it came to Australia as part of the First Fleet. The astounding thing is that this star, which is now quite low in the western horizon, was used thousands of years ago by the Egyptians to work out very accurately the length of the year. You see, what they would do is they would look at its setting in relation to the sun, and then for about 70 days, the star Sirius would be lost in the glare of the sun. And that very first day that Sirius popped out, if you like, of that glare and could be seen independently of the sun is something called heliacal rise. And when they were able to see that, they would work out the length of one year to the next, and by year after year after year of observations, they worked out that the average length of the year was 365 1/4 days. Not bad, considering they did this several thousand years ago. But what is it now? We see a bright star setting in the west, and, well, I have to tell you, it's actually part of a constellation. A constellation is simply a group of stars, an area of the sky. This particular area is supposed to be the large hunting dog, Canis Major. It's probably a little bit too low for us to make out all of the dog at the moment, so we'll have to wait a little bit longer and come back for that one. If you found Sirius, what I want you to do is turn towards your right ever so slightly, and not far away there's another reasonably bright star. In fact, it's the eighth brightest star in the night sky, and it's called Procyon. And Procyon is the brightest star in the constellation of the small dog. Now look, we're a bit late for it, but I still want you to try. If you look around, there's not many bright stars over in this part of the sky at all. In fact, Procyon, if you simply draw a line down towards the northwestern horizon, there's just one other nearby bright star. Supposedly, those two stars, join them together, you get the smaller of the two hunting dogs of Orion. Orion is well and truly gone at this time of year, so we have no chance of seeing him. And his hunting dogs, the greater and the lesser dogs, are also probably getting a little bit too hard for us to see at this particular point in time. As we continue around towards your right, and that is taking us up towards the northwest, come up against the first of our zodiac constellations, and that is Cancer the Crab. But sadly, you have absolutely no chance of seeing Cancer. It's a very dim constellation. It was significant in the past, thousands upon thousands of years ago, because it was the position of the solstice. So the sun would seem to glide sideways in relation to stars in this part of the sky. So they named it after an animal that seem to walk sideways. Fairly logical conclusion, Cancer the Crab. Unfortunately, you just can't see much of it. So we're going to skip Cancer and head around a little bit further and slightly higher, and we're going to see one of the oldest and most famous of all constellations, Leo the Lion. What you're looking for in this part of the sky is pretty much one relatively bright star, which is called Regulus. It's one of the four royal stars. Now, this is an idea that dates back several thousand years to an area between those magnificent rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, Mesopotamia. What people noticed was that the vernal equinox had occurred in the constellation of Taurus the Bull, which we can't see at the moment. Near this star that we're looking at the moment, Regulus, was the summer solstice. So by this stage, it had drifted from Cancer the Crab into Leo the Lion. So this bright star became the second of the four royal stars, along with Antares in Scorpius, which was the marker for the autumnal equinox, and Fomalo in the constellation Pisces Astrinus, the southern fish, for the winter solstice.
That's the Powerhouse Museum's senior astronomy educator, Jeff White. For more details, go to sydneyobservatory.com.au. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And that's the show for now. A special thanks to ABC Radio National and the ABC Science Unit for all their help and facilities. I'm Stuart Gary, and we'll be back next week with more Star Stuff.